Jag är Nora. Jag sorts Pias Elgard. För jag är Stubor. Ogas. Och Strad. Jag säger. Jag vill ha. Jag sorts Nora Ayar. Zero.
Welcome to the 376th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm Felbrick. Today, we start with a new book. We'll be travelling with Henry Stanley of the Dr. Livingstone, I presume, fame. Although this is not that story. This is a book called Through South Africa. And we'll follow that up with part 7 of The Boats of the Glen Carrick by William Hope Hodgson. Let's head to that dark continent. Through South Africa by Henry M. Stanley. Preface. This little volume consists of the letters I wrote from Bulawayo, Johannesburg and Pretoria for the journal South Africa, which is exclusively devoted to matters relating to the region whence it derives its title. Each letter contains the researches of a week. As the public had already a sufficiency of books dealing with the history, geography, politics, raids and revolts, I confined myself to such impressions as one who since 1867 had been closely connected with the equatorial northern and western Africas, might derive from a first view of the interior of South Africa. Being in no way associated with any political or pecuniary concern relating to the country, it struck me that my open-minded, disinterested and fresh impressions might be of some interest to others who, like myself, had only a general sympathy with its civilization and commercial development. And as I had necessarily to qualify myself for appearing in a journal which had for years treated of South African subjects, it involved much personal inquiry and careful consideration of facts communicated to Roe and an impartial weighing of their merits. To this motive, whatever may be the value of what I have written, I am greatly indebted personally. For henceforth, I must carry with me for a long time a valuable kind of knowledge concerning the colonies and states I traversed, which no number of books could have given to me. If, from my point of judgment, I differ in any way from other writers, all I care to urge is that I have some experience of my own in several new lands like the South African interior, and I've lived long enough to have seen the effects of what was good and what was bad policy in them. I prefer peaceful relations between England and the Boers of South Africa, if possible. I love what is just, fair, and best to and both for Britons and Boers. I naturally admire large-minded enterprise. I pity narrow-mindedness and dislike to see people refusing to advance when all the world is so sympathetic and helpfully inclined towards them. These explanations, I think, will enable anyone to understand the spirit of these letters. A curious thing occurred in connection with my sudden departure for South Africa. In the latter part of September 1897, I was debating with my family at a seaside hotel near Dieppe as to the place we should visit after the adjournment of Parliament in 1898. After discussing the merits of many suggestions, it was finally determined that we should all try South Africa, because it was said to have such a divine climate. The country was, moreover, so interesting politically, and as it loomed so much in the public interest, it would be worthwhile to obtain some personal knowledge of South Africans at home. We'd scarcely arrived at this conclusion when the postman brought us a telegram, which to our intense surprise was a request from Bulawayo Festivities Committee that I should go to Bulawayo to attend the celebration of the arrival of the Great Peninsula Railway at the capital of Matabeleland. We regarded it as a strange coincidence. This opportunity to visit Bulawayo I considered rather premature, as towards the end of autumn many engagements crowd upon one. But after another animated family council, it was resolved that I should accept the invitation, were it only to qualify myself as a pioneer for the ladies. We left Southampton on the Norman on the 9th of October. I found then that there were 5 other members of the House of Commons on board, Messrs. Sanderson, Llewellyn, Hayes, Fisher, Peace, and Poulton, and the Duke of Roxburgh, representing the House of Lords. Among the passengers there were Boers from Pretoria and Cape Colony, British Uitlanders from Johannesburg, English residents from the Cape and two Dutch republics, Afrikaner farmers and vine growers and townspeople, some from the Cape District, others from the eastern and western provinces, and not a few from Kimberley and Natal, besides a few ex-raiders and reformers. As may be imagined, there was no lack of instructive material, and naturally much divergence of political opinion. The smoking room soon became like a debating club, but notwithstanding the frankness and partisan character of the debates, the good temper with which each person delivered himself of his opinions was most astonishing. From the Boers and the Afrikaners, I heard not one favourable remark about England, but all indulged in banter and irony to prove that argument with them was of no avail. So extreme was their dislike that they even said English servants and clerks are of no use, and they are most unreliable, as for instance, and here followed incidents to prove what they said. While the English were false and could not be trusted, it was said that the Germans were good in the colonial sense, and made the best citizens. They were industrious and thrifty, and their improved condition did not alter their habits. The indenturing of the Bechana rebels was a subject upon which much was said by both sides, but a Boer's way of putting it was characteristic. England, you say, considers it illegal? Ah, well, the English know nothing of the matter, and what they say don't count. Rose Innes, however, ought to have known better. Had he been asked by Cape Farmer Weather to keep the rebels from starving, we should give them work to do for wages. Rose Innes would have said, "It is a good thing, and the best that can be done for them." But with the view of forming a party against the government, of course, he denounces indenturing as illegal and iniquitous. I have cited these extracts to show the process of how we became initiated into South African politics. The treatment of natives by the Rhodesian government was, according to the general opinion of Cape people, more liberal than they deserved, and such as any white colonist of no matter what country would approve. It was said, "Why, if we were to be governed by what these sentimental English societies, referring to the APS, think is right, we should have to abandon Africa altogether, for neither our lives nor property would be safe. Law-abiding men and lawless natives cannot live together, unless one or the other is compelled to, and as we've taken the country and intend to live in it, common sense tells us that the natives must submit to the same law under which we must live." The greatest majority by far denounced the raid, and yet everyone spoke kindly of the personality of Dr. Jameson. A gentleman from the eastern province informed me that the Jameson family had suffered greatly in the public estimation. One of the brothers who lived at King Williamstown had felt himself obliged to leave the province and return to England. And if the doctor succeeded in being elected to Cape Parliament, it was said he would be certain to meet with much unpleasantness. I believe there were 1,097 souls on board the Norman on this voyage. The noise was therefore terrific and continuous, and if any of the weaker constitutions suffered as much as I did through want of sleep and rest, they must on arrival at Cape Town have been in a pitiable state. Above and below, it was perpetual unrest and uproar. Though large and beautiful, these Cape steamers are badly designed internally, and the cabins are extremely small, and so arranged that a passenger is subject to the caprices of his neighbours on either side. My neighbours were unfortunately quite ignorant of the meaning of the word considerate. When an Ismay, such as he who reformed the Anglo-American service, becomes interested in the passenger traffic to the Cape, he will find a multitude of little things to improve. On returning to England, I found the SS Moore much superior for passenger accommodation. The inconveniences arise from an overcrowded steamer are too many to be disposed of in a paragraph, but it is enough to say that I was uncommonly glad when the voyage was ended, and I was free to seek a hotel. It must impress anyone who takes a sympathetic interest in what he sees in South Africa that in some things the country is far behind New Zealand or Tasmania or any of the Australian colonies. It is more backward than any of them in its hotels. There are, within my knowledge, only 3 hotels in all South Africa to which I would venture to recommend a lady to go. South Africans, of course, are able to endure anything, and as the Veld is comparatively but a step from most towns, any place that offers a decent lodging must be regarded by the men at least as infinitely superior to an ox wagon, a zinc hut or a farm shed. But I am thinking more of the effect such hotels as those of Cape Town must have on people from Europe. The city, which is a capital of the Cape Colony, contains a population of about 52,000, exclusive of the suburbs, but it does not possess a single hotel that would bear comparison with those of Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Auckland, Christchurch, or Dunedin. The very best is only just suited for commercial travellers, who must needs be satisfied with whatever they may offer. The suburbs, however, which are peopled by about 32,000, and it is well that invalids and tourists should remember it, contain hotels where rest and quiet may be found, in the midst of oak and fir groves and scenes of surpassing beauty. No city that I know of in our colonies possesses superior suburbs. They are simply lovely. They are stretched along the base of Table Mountain, and an entire day's carriage drive would not exhaust the exquisite beauty for which the suburbs of Cape Town are famed. Cape Colony possesses 3 valuable assets, which seem to me to have received scant attention. A traveller who has visited Southern California and Arizona will understand immediately that he visits South Africa what fortunes might be made of the wasteland, the rainfall, and the glorious climate with which nature has blessed it. The land is unworthily despised. The rainfall is allowed to waste itself in thirsty sands deep down beneath the level of hungry plains, while the climate does not seem to have suggested to any capitalist that a revenue superior to that obtained from the main reef at Johannesburg might be drawn from it. The leaders of South African enterprise appear all too absorbed in diamonds, gold mines, or dynamite. If I were to follow the authority of Worsfold in the South Africa pages 126 and 127, I should have to admit that this indifference to the land, the rainfall and the climate is due to the Boers. Captain Percival, in 1796, 100 years ago, wrote, quote, "The Dutch farmers never assist the soil by flooding. Their only labour is sowing the seed, leaving the rest to chance and the excellent climate. No part of the world has had its natural advantages so abused as the Cape of Good Hope. The very minds and dispositions of the settlers interfere with every plan of improvement and public utility." End quote. It may be that the Boers do cling to old-fashioned ideas somewhat more tenaciously than they ought to do, but they cannot possibly interfere with capitalists uniting to build up-to-date hotels on the most salubrious and scenic sites in Cape Colony, and beautifying their neighbourhoods with shade trees and gardens, so that the thousands of invalids who throng the watering places and hydros of Europe endure the snows of Davos and the winter of Endergadine, might be tempted to try the Karoo of the colony. They did not interfere with John D. Logan when he brought 100,000 acres of Karoo at Magersfontein and proceeded to turn it into remunerative account. They do not object to private companies or individuals making irrigation works, or planting groves, which thrive so wonderfully, and as Cape Colony has been British for over 90 years, it is rather hard that the Boers should bear all the blame. Now the Cape government may well plead guilty to having left many things undone which they ought to have done. I sincerely believe that the time will come when the climate, which has the quality of making old men young and the consumptive strong, will become universally known and appreciated. But to attract the invalids from the crowded Riviera and Switzerland, visitors must not be lodged in third-rate hotels near the noisy tram lines and fed on tinned meats. I was about concluding this preface when a South African appeared at my house and drew my attention to the scriptural quotation in my Johannesburg letter. Quote, "It is expedient that one man should die for many," end quote. And he begged me to make my meaning clear. I read the paragraph over again, and I see that, to a willful, contentious mind, it might be construed into a meaning very different to what I intended, and I will try to make that clearer here. Certain Johannesburgers at the club had related to us the story of the various efforts they had made to obtain their political rights, and the reforms which were needed to work their mines profitably. And after they had finished, I replied that everyone was well aware of the demonstrations, mass meetings, speeches, petitions to Kruger, Menesson's, Jameson's raid, and so on, and they themselves had just informed me how often they had yielded to bribery of officials, and yet withal, they confessed they were not a whit further advanced. Their position had not been bettered, and was somewhat worse. The corrective of it all, I said, seems to me to lie in the scriptural verse, "It is expedient that one man should die for many." There is a vast mass of sympathy in England with you, but it is inert and inactive. To make that sympathy a living force in your behalf, it must be proved that you are in earnest, that nothing sordid lies behind this dissatisfaction. You must prove that you have a cause for which you are willing to suffer, even to death. You say that you cannot do nothing without arms. You do not need any arms that I see. If you fight with weapons, you will be overcome, and I do not think your defeat will excite great sympathy. But if it be true that the impositions on you are intolerable, your taxes heavy, the claims of government extortionate, and the demands excessive, why submit to them? It seems to me that if you were all united in determination to pay no more of these claims, taxes, and bribes, and folded your arms and dared them to do their worst, that Kruger must either yield or proceed to compulsion of some kind. He would probably confiscate your property, or put you in prison or banish you. Whatever he does that is violent and tyrannical will cause such an explosion of that opinion that will prove to you all England does not forget her children. No cause was ever won without suffering, and I'm afraid that your cause, however good it may be, cannot be won without sacrifice and suffering of some kind. The leader of any movement is sure to be the object of the tyrant's hate, and the leader or leaders of your cause might not venture it in without being prepared to suffer and endure whatever ills may follow. Having explained the scriptural quotation at the request of the others, I now proceed to more definite in my own behalf with regard to the statement in the letter that we cannot interfere until we know what Johannesburg has resolved upon doing. A gentleman present said that during his recent visit to London, an English statesman asked him, quote, "What would be the effect of sending 30,000 British troops to the Transvaal?" End quote. Whereupon he answered that he would be the first man who would take up his rifle against them. This gentleman was an Englishman by birth. He'd been the loudest and the most eloquent against the British government for their disregard of the rights guaranteed by the Convention of 1884. He knew as well as anyone present the tenor of the dispatches that had been exchanged between the British government and the Transvaal Republic, and was perfectly acquainted with the patient and continuous efforts the Colonial Office had made to obtain a just consideration for the grievances of the Uitlanders. It was obvious to us that, if British statesmen had asked such a question, it must have been with the view of knowing, if diplomacy failed, what result would follow the final attempt to induce Kruger to listen to reason. From the shock this declaration from such a prominent Uitlander gave me and a colleague of mine, we understood what the feelings of the statesman referred to must have been, and we had no option left than to suppose the Uitlanders, despite all of their clamour and affected indignation against the Transvaal government, would prefer the Colonial Office to continue writing dispatches than to take any coercive measures. It must be an immense relief to Englishmen all over the country, as well as it was to me, to know that we are not expected to be at the trouble and cost of sending troops, and we may all feel sure that the dispatch writing is considered to be efficacious. The Colonial Office will not begrudge the labour nor spare the expense in stationery. At any rate, seeing that the Uitlanders have told us frankly what to expect if we resort to force for their assistance, it is too obvious that nothing more can be done by our government further than courteous diplomacy permits, until the united voice and the united action of the whole body of the Uitlanders certify to us in what other way England can serve them. Henry M. Stanley, London, January 28, 1898. And now for the seventh part of The Boats of the Glen Carrick. Chapter 7. The Island in the Weed. It was as we were all discussing the matter of the devil face that had peered up at me out of the water that Job, the ordinary seaman, discovered the island in the light of the growing dawn, and seeing it, sprang to his feet with so loud a cry that we were like for the moment to have thought that we'd seen a second demon. Yet when we made discovery of that which he had already perceived, we checked our blame at his sudden shout, for the sight of land after so much desolation made us very warm in our hearts. Now at first the island seems but a very small matter, for we did not know at that time that we viewed it from its end. Yet despite this, we took to our oars and rowed with all haste towards it, and so coming nearer were able to see that it had a greater size than we had imagined. Presently, having cleared one end of it and keeping to that side which was further from the great mass of the weed continent, we opened out a bay that curved inward to a sandy beach, most seductive to our tired eyes. Here, for the space of a minute, we paused to survey the prospect, and I saw that the island was of a very strange shape, having a great hump of black rock at either end, and dipping down to a steep valley between them. In this valley, there seemed to be a deal of a strange vegetation that had the appearance of mighty toadstools, and down nearer the beach there was a thick grove of a kind of very tall reed, and these we discovered afterwards to be exceedingly tough and light, having something of the qualities of bamboo. Regarding the beach, it might have been most reasonably supposed that it would be very thick with the driftweed, but this was not so, at least not at that time. Though a projecting horn of the black rock which ran out into the sea from the upper end of the island was thick with it. And now the boatswain, having assured himself that there was no appearance of any danger, we bent to our oars, and presently had the boat aground upon the beach, and here, finding it convenient, we made our breakfast. During this meal the boatswain discussed with us the most proper thing to do, and it was decided to push the boat off from the shore, leaving Job in her, whilst the remainder of us made some exploration of the island. And so, having made an end of eating, we proceeded as we had determined, leaving Job in the boat, ready to scull ashore for us if we were pursued by any savage creature, while the rest of us made our way towards the nearer hump, from which, as it stood some 100 feet above the sea, we hoped to get a very good idea of the remainder of the island. First, however, the boatswain handed out to us the two cutlasses and the cut and thrust, the other two cutlasses being in Josh's boat, and taking one himself, he passed me the cut and thrust, and gave the other cutlass to the biggest of the men. Then he bade the others to keep their sheathed knives handy, and was proceeding to lead the way when one of them called out to us to wait for a moment, and with that ran quickly to the clump of reeds. Here he took one with both his hands and bent upon it, but it would not break, so that he had to notch it with his knife, and thus in a little he had it clear. After this he cut off the upper part, which was too thin and lissome for his purpose, and then thrust the handle of his knife into the end portion which he had retained, and in this wise he had a most serviceable lance or spear, for the reeds were very strong and hollow after the fashion of bamboo, and when he had bound some yarn about the end to which he had thrust his knife, so as to prevent it splitting, it was a fit enough weapon for any man. Now the boatswain, perceiving the happiness of the fellow's idea, bade thus the rest to make themselves similar weapons, and whilst they were busy thus he commended the man very warmly. And so in a little, being now most comfortably armed, we made inland towards the nearer Black Hill, in very good spirits. Presently we came to the rock which formed the hill, and found that it came up out of the sand with great abruptness, so that we could not climb it on the seaward side. At that the boatswain led us round a space towards the side where lay the valley, and here there was underfoot neither sand nor rock, but ground of strange and spongy texture. And then suddenly, rounding a jutting spur of the rock, he came upon the first of the vegetation, an incredible mushroom. Nay, I should say a toadstool, for it had no healthy look about it, and gave out a heavy, mouldy odour. And now we perceived that the valley was filled with them, all, that is, save for a great circular patch where nothing appeared to be growing, though we were not as yet of sufficient height to ascertain the reason of this. Presently, we came to a place where the rock was split by a great fissure running from the top, and showing many ledges and convenient shelves upon which we might obtain hold and footing. And so we set to about climbing, helping one another so far as we had the ability, until in about the space of some 10 minutes we'd reached the top, and from thence had a very fine view. We perceived now that there was a beach upon that side of the island which was opposed to the weed, though unlike that upon which we had landed, it was greatly choked with weed, which had drifted ashore. After that I gave notice to see what space of water lay between the island and the edge of the great weed continent, and guessed it to be no more than maybe some 90 yards, at which I fell to wishing that it had been greater, for I was grown very much in awe of the weed, and the strange things which I conceived it to contain. Abruptly the boatswain clapped me upon the shoulder, and pointed to some object that lay out in the weed at a distance of not much less than 1/2 mile from where we stood. Now at first I could not conceive what manner of thing it was at which I stared, until the boatswain, remarking my bewilderment, informed me that it was a vessel, all covered in, and no doubt as a protection against the devilfish and other strange creatures in the weed. And now I began to trace the hull of her amid all that hideous growth. But of her masts I could discern nothing, and I doubted not that they had been carried away by some storm ere she was caught by the weed. And then thought came to me, of the end of those who had built up that protection against the horrors which the weed world held amongst its slime. Presently I turned my gaze once more upon the island, which was very plain to see from where we stood. I conceived now that I could see so much of it that its length would be near to 1/2 mile, though its breadth was something under 400 yards, thus it was very long in proportion to its width. In the middle part it had less breadth than at the ends, being perhaps 300 yards at its narrowest, and 100 yards wider at its broadest. Upon both sides of the island, as I've made already a mention, there was a beach, though this extended no great distance along the shore, the remainder being composed of the black rock of which the hills were formed. And now, having a closer regard to the beach upon which the weed side of the island, I discovered amidst the wrack that had been cast ashore there a portion of the lower mast and topmast of some great ship, with rigging attached, but the yards were all gone. This find I pointed out to the boatswain, remarking that it might prove of use for firing. But he smiled at me, telling me that the dried weed would make a very abundant fire, and at this without going to the labour of cutting the mast into suitable logs. And now he, in turn, called my attention to the place where the huge fungi had come to a stop in their growing, and I saw that in the centre of the valley there was a great circular opening in the earth, like to the mouth of a prodigious pit. And it appeared to be filled within a few feet of the mouth with water, over which spread a brown and horrid scum. Now, as may be supposed, I stared with some intentness at this, for it had the look of having been made with labour, being very symmetrical. Yet I could not conceive that I was deluded by the distance, and that it would have been a rougher appearance when viewed from a nearer standpoint. From contemplating this, I looked down upon the little bay in which our boat floated. Job was sitting in the stern, sculling gently with the steering oar, and watching us. At that I waved my hand to him in friendly fashion, and he waved back. And then, even as I looked, I saw something in the water under the boat, something dark-coloured that was all of a move. The boat appeared to be floating over it, as over a mass of sunken weed. And then I saw that whatever it was rising to the surface. At this a sudden horror came over me, and I clutched the boatswain by the arm and pointed, crying out that there was something under the boat. Now the boatswain, as soon as he saw the thing, ran forward to the brow of the hill, and placing his hands to his mouth after the fashion of a trumpet, sang out to the boy to bring the boat to shore and to make fast the painter to a large piece of rock. At the boatswain's hail, the lad called out, "Aye, aye," and standing up gave a sweep with his oar that brought the boat's head round towards the beach. Fortunately for him, he was no more than some 30 yards from the shore at this time, else he had never come to it in this life. For the next moment the moving brown mass beneath the boat shot out a great tentacle, and the oar was torn out of Job's hands with such power as to throw him right over on the starboard gunwale of the boat. The oar itself was drawn down and out of sight, and for a minute the boat was left untouched. Now the boatswain cried out to the boy to take another oar and to get ashore while still he had a chance. And at that we all called out various things, one advising one thing and another recommending some other. Yet our advice was vain, for the boy moved not, at which some cried out that he was stunned. I looked now to where the brown thing had been, for the boat had moved a few fathoms from the spot, having got some way upon her before the oar was snatched. And thus I discovered that the monster had disappeared, having, I conceive, sunk again to the depth from which it had risen. Yet it might reappear at any moment, and in that case the boy would be taken before our eyes. At this juncture the boatswain called to us to follow him, and led the way to the great fissure up which we had climbed. And so in a minute we were each of us scrambling down with what haste we could make towards the valley. And all the while I dropped from ledge to ledge, I was full of torment to know whether the monster had returned. The boatswain was the first man to reach the bottom of the cleft, and he set off immediately round the base of the rock to the beach, the rest of us following him as we made safe our footing in the valley. I was the third man down, but being light and fleet of foot, I passed the second man and caught up with the boatswain just as he came upon the sand. Here I found that the boat was within some 5 fathoms of the beach, and I could see Job still lying insensible, but of the monster there was no sign. And so matters were, the boat nearly a dozen yards from the shore and Job lying insensible in her, with somewhere neath her keel, for all that we knew, a great monster, and we helpless upon the beach. Now I could not imagine how to save the lad. And indeed I fear he had been left to destruction, for I had deemed it madness to try and reach the boat by swimming. But for the extraordinary bravery of the boatswain, who, without hesitating, dashed into the water and swam boldly out to the boat, which, by the grace of God, he reached without mishap and climbed in over the bows. Immediately he took the painter and hove it to us, bidding us tail onto it and bring the boat to shore without delay. By this method of gaining the beach he showed wisdom. For in this wise he escaped attracting the attention of the monster by unneedful stirring of the water, as he would surely have done had he made use of an oar. Yet despite his care, we had not finished with the creature. For just as the boat grounded, I saw the lost steering oar shoot up half its length out of the sea. And immediately there was a mighty splather in the water astern, and the next instant the air seemed full of huge whirling arms. At that the boatswain gave one look behind, and seeing the thing upon him, snatched the boy into his arms and sprang over the bows onto the sand. Now at the sight of the devil fish, we'd all made for the back of the beach at a run, none troubling even to retain the painter. And because of this we were like to have lost the boat, for the great cuttlefish had its arms all splayed about it, seeming to have a mind to drag it down into the deeper water from whence it had risen. And it had possibly succeeded, but that the boatswain brought us all to our senses, for having laid Job out of harm's way, he was the first to seize the painter, which lay trailed upon the sand, and at that we got back our courage and ran to assist him. Now there happened to be convenient a great spike of rock, the same, indeed, to which the boatswain had bidden Job tie the boat, and to this we ran the painter, taking a couple of turns about it with 2 half hitches. And now, unless the rope carried away, we had no reason to fear the loss of the boat, though there seemed to us to be a danger of the creature crushing it. Because of this, and because of a feeling of natural anger against the thing, the boatswain took up from the sand one of the spears which had been cast down when we'd hauled the boat ashore. With this he went down so far as he seemed safe, and prodded the creature in one of its tentacles, the weapon entering easily, at which I was surprised, for I had understood that these creatures were near to invulnerable in all parts, save for their eyes. At receiving this stab, the great fish appeared to feel no hurt, for he showed no signs of pain, and at that the boatswain was further emboldened to go nearer, so that he might deliver a more deadly wound. Yet scarce had he taken 2 steps before the hideous thing was upon him, and but for the agility wonderful in so great a man, he'd been destroyed. Yet, spite of so narrow an escape from death, he was not the less determined to wound or to destroy the creature, and to this end he dispatched some of us to the Grove of Reeds to get half a dozen of the strongest, and when we returned with these he bade two of the men lash their spears securely to them, and by this means they now had spears of a length of between 30 and 40 feet. With these it was possible to attack the devilfish without coming within reach of its tentacles, and now being ready, he took one of the spears, telling the biggest of the men to take the other. Then he directed him to aim for the right eye of the huge fish, whilst he would attack the left. Now since the creature had so nearly escaped the boatswain, it had ceased to tug at the boat, and lay silent with its tentacles spread all about it, and its great eyes appearing just over the stern, so that it presented an appearance of watching our movements, though I doubt if it saw us with any clearness, for it must have been dazed with the brightness of the sunshine. And now the boatswain gave the signal to attack, at which he and the man ran down upon the creature with their lances, as it were, in rest. The boatswain's spear took the monster truly in its left eye, but the one wielded by the man was too bendable, and sank so much that it struck the stern post of the boat, the knife blade snapping off short. Yet it mattered not, for the wound inflicted by the boatswain's weapon was so frightful that the giant cuttlefish released the boat and slid back into the deep water, churning it to foam and gouting blood. For some minutes we waited to make sure that the monster had indeed gone, and after that we hastened to the boat and drew her up so far as we were able, after which we unloaded the heaviest of her contents, and so were able to get her right clear of the water. For an hour afterwards, the sea all about the little beach was stained black, and in places, red. And that's all for today. Except to remind you about my Patreon account, where you can support my production of audiobooks. As a patron, you get access not just to the stories published here in the podcast, but also all the other books I record. At the moment, I'm recording a Napoleonic memoir called Recollections of a Peninsula Veteran, also Lost on Venus by Edgar Rice Burroughs, and the first volume of The Pentagon Papers, which reveals the dark underbelly of the US's decision-making on the war in Vietnam. Please go to patreon.com and search there for Felbrigg. That's F-E-L-B-R-I-G-G. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. So, until next time.